I'm very happy now to welcome Elizabeth Wood. She's a professor of political science at Yale University and member of the external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much, Mary Charlotte.
So you are studying the horrific topic of sexual violence, including rape and torture and slavery and killing during wartime. How did you come to this subject?
There were two reasons. My first two books focused on civil wars in El Salvador and the conflict in South Africa. And after I finished those two books, I was then beginning to think that what I wanted to do was to work on a topic more broadly comparative, looking at violence across civil wars in a much more general way. And at that time, it was also clear that there was sexual violence of different forms on the part of a lot of different armed actors, but there was very little academic work on the subject. So I put those two together and then began this focus on this topic, which, as you mentioned, is indeed horrific.
And it's also as old as history itself, as old as human war itself.
That's right. We know from the literature from the ancient Greeks that rape occurred during those conflicts. We know during World War II that rape of civilians on the part of the Soviet Army and the Japanese Army was particularly horrific. So we know that this is not a recent phenomenon. This goes way, way back.
And at the same time, there are a lot of stereotypes about rape and sexual violence during war which turn out not to be true.
That's exactly right. So often we go from this fact that rape is a long-standing pattern in human history to then presume that therefore it's ubiquitous, and that's not true. In a study of all major conflicts between 1980 and 2009, all major civil conflicts, 17% of those conflicts showed no reported rape, and 21% of them showed only isolated reports of rape. So that's something like 38% of these civil conflicts, there were no reports or no more than isolated reports of rape. Moreover, in some of these conflicts when there is rape, it occurs in a very asymmetric pattern. So one party to the civil war may engage in widespread rape, but the other group does not respond in kind.
And that was El Salvador.
Exactly. El Salvador is a prime example of that. Vast abuse of civilians by state forces, including rape, in two settings. One was during the massacres early in the war, and the other was a sustained pattern of sexual abuse of both men and women in detention. But that pattern of asymmetry suggests that we shouldn't be thinking about the conflict. We should be thinking about the different armed groups that are members of that conflict, parties to the conflict.
So in El Salvador, the rebels did not rape.
Right.
How do you account for that?
Well, that is one of the most important features of this emerging literature. And maybe this is a good time to mention that I'll be talking not just about my own work, but there's a number of young scholars who are doing the cutting edge work in this field, and I'll be talking about their work as well. So in El Salvador, we know because of a recent dissertation of a Yale student that what the FMLN did was not only strictly prohibit abuse of civilians, particularly rape, but they also built institutions to enforce that prohibition.
What did that look like?
So in the case of the FMLN, it was a matter of ongoing socialization of their members in the purpose of the war, and given the purpose of the war, which was to build a more just society, that it was inconsistent to abuse civilians, that it was civilians on whose behalf they were fighting. And they translated this into a set of rules that would govern the behavior of the combatants. And when the student did this research, many years after the war, they could all still recite what the rules were. In contrast, the soldiers, they had only the vaguest idea of why they were fighting and could not recite any rules that governed their behavior over civilians.
So would you say that a belief, an ideology in social justice is associated with less rape and abuse of civilians?
Well, that's where it gets complicated, not necessarily, because, for example, in a different kind of war, you might have an ethnic group that is attempting to secede from the nation, and that ethnic group may be doing so on grounds of social justice for its members. And some of those groups might embrace widespread violence against members of other ethnic groups, including rape, and could persuade themselves that they were doing that on grounds of social justice. But that is a good point, that it seems that in general, groups that embrace an ideology about fighting to govern more justly on the behalf of all civilians, there seems to be a weak tendency to engage in less abuse of civilians.
Weak tendency meaning sometimes you see this, sometimes not.
Right. So in a statistical sense, that there's a weak tendency. Yeah.
So getting back to the central question, I mean, we still have a world in which soldiers rape civilians, men rape women, and we'll get into men are also abused, but I mean, soldiers rape civilian women during war. Why do they do it?
Well, let me back up for just a second, because what you just said is very important, which is you said soldiers rape civilian women. And another myth that governs a lot of the media coverage, and it's great that the topic is getting so much media coverage, but one misconception that the media tends to promote is that it's rebel groups, that is, members of non-state armed groups that abuse civilians more. But we know from the emerging data on this that it's more often state groups, that is, soldiers, who engage in the abuse of women. But not all of them. So again, looking at civil conflicts in Africa, 64% of the armed actors were not reported to have engaged in rape of civilians. So that included states and that included many non-state actors. So this is not a ubiquitous fact of war. But sadly, some armies do rape civilian women.
And back to the question, why do they do it?
So a misconception in the literature is that when armed groups engage in widespread rapes, states, for example, that they're doing it as a strategy of war. And this then implies that it's ordered, that it is a thought-out strategy in the sense of one that's seen to have overall beneficial effects. And there are such cases. We know, for example, that the Bosnian Serbs ordered their combatants to rape. We know that, for example, also there's evidence that in Guatemala soldiers were ordered to rape. But it seems much more frequent that it's not that they've been ordered to rape, it's rather that soldiers are doing it and it's being tolerated by the chain of command.
So let's look at those two different cases. When they are ordered to rape, it is a strategy of war.
That's correct.
And what are they trying to accomplish?
So sometimes it is understood by commanders to be an effective way to ethnically cleanse an area. So one of the classic settings and one of the early warning signs for the possible emergence of widespread rape is where you have one ethnic group forcing members of another group out of an area. In some cases, but not in all, rape is used. And one can see why, because that brings then very bitter memories about that setting, that village, that house, that compound, particularly when the rape was public, which it often is in these settings. And so the commanders may reason that this is an effective way just to get rid of people such that they will not even want to return.
And so then the people who've been raped, the women who've been raped, their families just go away and they become refugees somewhere.
Exactly. And again, the idea of why use rape rather than just forcing them out is to break their tie, break their desire to even return to the area. But there are other reasons. Sometimes it is purely punitive. So we know as the Soviet army at the end of World War II was moving westward across Europe, they raped a lot of women, but there was a particular focus on German women. And particularly after the siege of Berlin, there was massive rape of German women. So it was a punitive, it was a way to punish the civilian population.
And, I mean, rape is such a horrific crime because it basically takes, I mean, I'm speaking as a woman, it takes this action which is essentially the act of loving another person and turns it into an act of violence and hatred, and kind of ruins you, at least for a while.
It ruins a person in a number of different senses. It can ruin one's sense of self, one's sense of being at peace in a secure world. It can ruin your physical health, your reproductive health. Some of the rapes during conflict are so brutal that women can no longer conceive, and indeed sometimes they die as a result of rape, particularly armed rape. But it can also ruin a woman socially. So if it becomes known that this woman, or indeed very often it's a young girl, has been raped, then she may be rejected by her family, by her husband if she's married, and her prospects for finding a life partner may be very, very low. But that varies. In some settings, families are more accepting of their daughters and sisters who've suffered rape.
There's also the phenomenon of gang rape, which happens during military conflicts. Yeah. What's the psychology? What's going on there?
So I think that's a very important question to raise, because it helps us begin to understand more deeply what's going on when groups of combatants rape. In the first place, you're absolutely right that the incidence of gang rape is just tremendously higher during war. Where it's been measured pretty well, it seems to be about 3/4 of rape are gang rapes, rather than what it varies across societies, but very often the fraction of rapes in peacetime can be 5 to 15% of rapes are gang rapes. And I think that this draws our attention to the fact that in these settings, soldiers, combatants, part of what they're doing is they're performing for each other. So this has become a way in these particular armed groups for combatants to have social status in front of their fellow soldiers. We know some settings where gang rape takes place by rank. The commander goes first, then it goes down by rank. And the newest recruits have the so-called opportunity last. And one pattern that is emerging in the literature, and this is work by a colleague at Harvard, what she is finding, both based on very detailed research in Sierra Leone, where there was massive rape and massive gang rape, but she shows that it's true more generally, is that one setting where this pattern of rape is likely to occur is where an armed group forcibly recruits its combatants. So this group may go from village to village trying to pick up teenagers, and then this armed group is forced with a problem. How do you go from a collection of reluctant, desperate to leave teenagers to a fighting army? Well, it seems one way is to force them to rape.
And that instills a bonding and cohesion in the group?
Exactly. And it does it for a couple of different reasons. One is if they're forced to rape in areas where, particularly in their own village or areas where they or their family is known, it really makes it very, very difficult for them to go back to that village, and therefore they are trapped in the life of the armed group. But also we know from studies of initiation rites in all sorts of different settings that costly and humiliating actions perversely often create a deep sense of identity with the group that forced you to do that. And that seems to be what's going on.
We're talking to political scientist Elizabeth Wood. What does all this say about masculinity? I mean, if you have a gang rape and people are finding identity and women are essentially non-humans, what does that say about human masculinity?
Well, it's very sobering, isn't it? But again, we need to remind ourselves that there are many armed groups that don't engage in rape of civilian women, and many of them are very effective armies. And that shows that it's quite possible to build a very effective military that is not based on a form of militarized masculinity that requires the humiliation and subjugation and raping of women. So it's not inevitable.
Do those people who don't do rape still do non-sexual torture?
Some of them do, some of them don't. So among some groups, there has been instilled a strong ethic of respect for civilians, except those that collaborate with the enemy. And in others, there may be a particular prohibition against sexual abuse, but other forms of abuse of civilians do occur. But there's another way in which masculinity comes into this, and this has been documented by some colleagues for the case of the Congo, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is that if, and this is for the state military, what they've documented through many, many interviews with soldiers in the Congo is that what seems to be going on to undergird the widespread rape by soldiers of women in the Congo is a kind of failed masculinity. So in that society, to be a man is to be a provider for a family, indeed an extended family. And the army may not even pay its men for months on end. And so soldiers can't support their family if they have one. They can't marry and begin a family in a prideful way if they don't. And what they document is that one way in which this frustration in the sense of failing to be a man is manifest in that context is through rape of civilian women. So it's functioning as a kind of compensation, a kind of booty of war, because they're not being compensated. So, but it is also a mark, as they themselves explain it, of what they call lust rape, that it is reflecting their failure to be able to realize the image of masculinity that they would like to have.
What you're saying makes me think of the way people talk about Middle Eastern terrorism is when you have large groups of young men who don't have economic opportunity and don't really have a way to have a kind of regular, stable life, that becomes very dangerous, and you get all kinds of expressions of that, whether it be terrorism or war or rape or whatever.
Well, certainly it's in poor societies that you may have non-state armed groups emerging to challenge the state. That's a very robust correlation in this recent literature on civil conflict, that such conflicts are much more likely in poorer countries. And that's one mechanism, that you have young people, not just young men, but also young women with very few prospects, and they may think, either for idealistic reasons to found a more just society or for very practical reasons to join an armed group.
This whole question really does make me think about and wonder, I mean, you've got groups of soldiers raping, gang raping, then the war is over and 10 years go by, and these people might look at their former selves and wonder, was that even me? I mean, it's so out of context and probably is not what people would ever do unless they were in that situation, whether or not they're ordered, but still in that situation of war and conflict and fear and terror and things like that.
So this is one way in which the pattern of wartime rape is quite different from the one pattern of rape in civilian life, which is the serial rapist who, you know, works very covertly, identifies and stalks a stranger victim, and then finally rapes her and possibly kills her. You know, this is a much more social kind of construction of abuse of civilians, and in particular rape, not just of women, but also of men.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. The rape and abuse of men during wartime is something that doesn't get a lot of airplay.
It doesn't, and tragically so, because where the question has been asked, it seems to be quite prevalent. And it's only in the last perhaps 5 years that researchers are beginning to focus on this as a phenomenon as troubling as the rape of women and girls, because for the same reasons. These are vulnerable civilians. Some of them are very young, and it has consequences that these victims suffer for an entire lifetime. So, for example, in the Eastern Congo, one survey of three of the most troubled provinces showed that about a quarter of boys and men had suffered some form of sexual violence in that context.
And is it for the same reasons?
So it's often for the same reasons. So one pattern of sexual abuse of men and boys is against those held in detention as suspects of supporting the other side. So sexual torture is one form of sexual violence against men that is quite common, sadly, particularly on the part of states. Now, it's only recently that researchers have begun to note that sexual torture should be categorized not just as torture, but also as sexual violence. So that's one setting, the abuse of detainees, torture of detainees. The other setting is the public humiliation of victims before a community. And there it's happening for the same reason it happens against women. It's public, it's humiliating. It's showing the domination of the armed group over civilian life in that area, and it's punishing a population for its failure to actively support the group.
You spoke a moment ago about the contrast between rape in wartime and in peacetime, and I mean, there are these horrible serial rapists, but there's also a lot of date rape, rape within relationships. The most common kind of rapes, at least as far as I know, are people who know each other. How does that whole phenomenon compare to rape during wartime?
So I think there are a couple of ways that it connects. One is the fact that under the cover of war, some men rape women that they know. So these may be girls that refuse to date them or refuse to marry them. And so one way to punish that young woman and her family is to rape under the cover of war. And we know some of that happened, for example, in Bosnia. More generally, one pattern of rape during war that's similar to some patterns of rape during civilian life is the way in which some gang rape occurs in prisons. For example, rape may occur on the part of urban gangs, and indeed in some fraternities there may be group sexual abuse of inebriated young women. And those kind of group social dynamics appear to be quite similar to those going on during gang rape on the part of armed groups. Your question raises, however, a different issue, which is whether the pattern of wartime rape reflects the patriarchy that was present in that society before the war. And so the kind of abuse of partners, domestic violence, perhaps what we see during war, is an amplification of that pattern, reflecting patriarchal social relations before the war. And an aspect of that is certainly true. It would be hard to think we could observe massive sexual violence without patriarchy at all. If women were as respected as men, then it would seem difficult to see the kinds of sexual violence, particularly against women, but also against so-called inferior men. On the other hand, there doesn't seem to be any relationship between, as best we can measure it, patriarchy during peace and the abuse of women through sexual violence during the war. And in particular, this fact that the pattern of sexual violence during a civil conflict can be so asymmetric suggests that a general cultural level of patriarchy can't explain the wartime level of sexual violence. And that's why in this emerging research, we focus much more narrowly on the armed group itself, rather than the conflict overall.
So if it's not just patriarchy, what are some of the other explanations that you're coming up with?
So one has to do with the way in which a group recruits, as I was speaking about before. Groups that forcibly recruit, there seems to be quite a strong tendency to also gang rape civilians as part of the socialization of combatants. So that's one pattern. At the other end of the spectrum, with groups that have very strong institutions, we may see a pattern of very little sexual violence, and that can happen in two different ways, speaking generally. One is by having very strong disciplinary institutions. So if the commander prohibits rape of civilians, and if those institutions are strong enough to institute that prohibition, then we will see little rape of civilians. But that requires there to be not just strong disciplinary institutions, but the commanders have to know when abuse is happening. So that requires also institutions that send a lot of information about what combatants are actually doing up the chain of command. The second way this can happen is by building institutions that very strongly socialize the group norms into the individual combatant. And that was the kind of pattern that we saw on the part of the Salvadoran rebels.
Right, because they believed so strongly in what they were fighting for, which was social justice and you don't rape. What you're saying, though, I mean, when you talk about the military chain of command and punishment, I mean, in the U.S. military, rape and sexual assault are illegal, and there are reports coming out all the time of these women who've been traumatized by their commanding officers, not even civilians, other soldiers.
Exactly, and not just U.S. service women, but also U.S. service men. So we know that those who report unwanted sexual assault, about half of them are men. And we know that those being treated by the veteran administrations, veterans who have suffered military sexual trauma, about half of them are men. Now, there are many more men in the military, so the fraction of men in the military who suffer sexual assault is much lower, but as the number of victims, it's about equivalent. That's right. And what is quite important to bear in mind is that it's not only been prohibited for a long time to assault your fellow service member, but in the last 5 years or so, the U.S. military has increasingly tried to make that effective. And as evident in the increasing reports of unwanted sexual contact, to date it's been a failure. That's given rise to calls within Congress, as well as calls within advocacy groups, for taking the prosecution and adjudication of these cases out of the chain of command entirely. That's very controversial. It's kind of a point of pride of commanders that they discipline their men. But at this point, it certainly seems to be a necessary step. Because
they're the ones doing it.
And in particular, there are two reasons. One is they may be doing it. But the other is a kind of perverse effect. As the U.S. military has tried to get more serious about this, it's then a demerit on the commanding officer's record if his soldier is raping. So even if a commanding officer knows that a pattern of sexual abuse by one of his men, he may not report that or discipline that to avoid a blot on his own record. And that's why we really need to take this outside the chain of command.
We're talking to political scientist Elizabeth Wood. I think there's a kind of big question here about respect for women, respect for people, dehumanization, because dehumanization is and has to be part of the training of soldiers. If you respected all people and all life, you could never kill anybody, and then you wouldn't have an effective army, which might be a good thing if everybody did that. But nevertheless, we hear so much about, and it would be nice to hear more about what this really looked like, but the dehumanization of U.S. soldiers, and part of that is pornography, and part of that is the humiliation of women in the way they're trained to think, and then at the same time they're told that they have to respect women, so it's got to be confusing for the 18-year-old recruit.
Yeah, and these are pretty deep-going patterns. So it's one thing for the brass to insist on respect for women and so on, but there may be a deep culture among recruits that gets passed along in small units that has a very abusive subculture. And we know from reading memoirs of soldiers about what some of those patterns are, and that may be very much in opposition to the brass. But we shouldn't be too pessimistic. There's some reports that the Navy and its kind of basic training is beginning to find ways to, in that early socialization of those 18-year-olds, to begin to make a difference so that the rates of sexual assault being reported in the course of that training, for example, is just way down. So even though overall reports of unwanted sexual contact seem to be going up in the U.S. military, it may be that the Navy's on to something.
And at the same time, I mean, the cynic in me says, oh, good, so they're learning to dehumanize the enemy without actually raping their fellow female soldiers.
So one big question, of course, that is often raised by some of the NGOs that have a broader view. Their position is, rather than working to end wartime rape, why don't we work to end war?
Good idea.
And so NGOs then take very different positions on that. So some NGOs on the ground in the Eastern DRC, for example, some of them have argued that they are answering such a great need on the part of the civilian population that for now that's their job. Others argue for a justice process that will actually hold perpetrators accountable and that they're working for that. And still others are trying to work for community reconciliation and reconciliation between armed groups. So it's a decision that activists and their organizations all around the world are facing. Do we work on this issue? Do we work on women suffering during war more generally? Because some NGOs with close ties to their constituency say that, well, yes, we have a fraction of women and girls who've suffered sexual violence, but when we talk with them, what they most want is education for their kids. What they most want are jobs and a way to support their family. And they see finding and holding perpetrators accountable as not as urgent as some of these other things. So that's a decision those organizations also have to make.
There's also, just basic questions of why people are fighting wars in the first place. You could make a very strong argument that in most cases it's not the most reasonable or effective way to solve a problem, like, for example, world energy issues, like the distribution of oil, sending tanks and bombs and airplanes and that kind of thing, as opposed to actually working out strategies for proper energy production and alternative energy production, all that. It would make a lot more sense to use our prodigious minds to solve problems than to use our brute force. And yet, half of our species are these sort of primates with warrior instincts. And it seems like it's almost like, well, we have to do that because we're men and that's how we solve problems. And we wouldn't be men if we didn't know how to be warriors.
Well, I guess I'm more optimistic than that. I hope that as we see the costs of war and as we think about the huge problems we as humans are facing, I hope that the more cooperative ways forward can loom large. Of course, as you point out, the long record of humans is that often we do resort to war. So I'm not all that optimistic. But I do want to note that since about the early 1990s, the number of civil wars in the world has been falling just pretty steadily. They were rising before that, but since then they've been falling. And that's very hopeful for wartime rape in particular, because if there are fewer civil conflicts around, then there may be, we don't know, but there may be less rape as well.
What kind of reports are you getting from Syria and other conflicts that are happening right now?
In Syria, there seems to be a pretty sustained pattern of abuse of both women and men on the part of the state forces, including the pro-government militias. It seems to take two patterns. One is what we've been talking about quite a lot, which is sexual torture, including rape of girls, women, boys, and men in detention. And the other is the rape of girls and women in their homes during operations. How frequent it is, we don't know. But we know that there are organizations like Human Rights Watch are documenting a steady set of reports.
And so international law, even if it were to be carried out, in the moment doesn't seem to make a difference, or does it?
So international law on this subject has advanced in just tremendously since the early 1990s. So, and this is a product of an international women's movement that just insisted in the aftermath of the kind of widespread rape in Rwanda and Bosnia that wartime rape had to be considered a war crime and under certain conditions had to be considered and prosecuted as a crime against humanity and indeed, on occasion, as genocide itself. So that's a huge achievement. There's now quite a body of case law where international courts of different kinds have held perpetrators accountable. That's a huge advance. Does it mean that the commander of a militia far from the reach of the international court is taking that into consideration? I think it's probably too soon to know, but the other effect that this growth of international law is having is to begin to change what national courts do. And so one of the very important policy agendas that I see in this field is not so tied to the international courts, but to build the capacity of national judicial systems, national police systems, to hold either under international law or their own domestic law, to hold perpetrators accountable for the kinds of sexual crimes that they engage in.
There's a question that comes up whether we're talking about war or whether we're talking about the Texas legislature, which is what happens to babies that are conceived during rape, and that must be a question that you look at.
It's not something I've looked at nearly as much as some other scholars have, and sadly, some of those innocent children are rejected by their communities along with their mother, or sometimes their mother may be accepted, but the children themselves are stigmatized. In some settings, women and girls seek out ways to abort that child as a way to avoid the living out the rest of their lives, the consequences of a heinous rape. And indeed, some societies allow even quite widespread abortion after mass rape. That varies quite a lot. But there are corners of the world where families, extended families, have been more welcoming to these children. So it varies enormously. But a very good question is why there hasn't been as much attention put on this issue as there have been on some other issues. It's been kind of a hidden theme in this field.
And so have you or have your colleagues talked to women who are pregnant with their war rapist babies?
Yes, some have. And these women, it seems, most often go through hell in the sense of struggling to imagine a future with this baby, to come to terms with, do they have an option not to have this baby or to give the child away under some conditions that they feel somewhat comfortable about in this very difficult situation. And it is one of the most difficult consequences of rape, the conception of a child in its aftermath.
Is it mostly women who are doing the kind of studies that you're doing?
Mostly, but not at all exclusively. There are a number of men, both scholars and activists, and doctors and other professionals who take this issue extremely seriously. So that's not the case that this is a field dominated by women. We have colleagues across these various subfields who are men working as hard as we are to end this phenomenon.
And what are your hopes for ending this phenomenon?
Well, the most important fact coming out of this body of research is that rape is not ubiquitous on the part of armed groups. And if that's the case, commanders, if they want to, can prohibit effectively their combatants from engaging in wartime rape. And if that's true, then rape is not inevitable during war, and we have grounds to hold accountable those groups and those commanders that do engage in wartime rape. And not just the soldiers, but their commanders. And I think that one of the ways forward is to continue to build the accountability of the command structure for the kind of abuse of civilians that their soldiers carry out.
We're talking to political scientist Elizabeth Wood. It remains that the whole world of war is one in which women are more or less powerless and peripheral, and men dominate, and there really is not equality in the context of war. And that's a state of mind that is a reality, and it seems like part of women's equality is minimizing or getting rid of war. I wondered how you felt about that.
I think that it's part not just of gender equality, but of a more equal world in terms of ethnic relations, maybe even generational relations. So if all groups felt that they had not just an equal stake in society, but equal resources to engage in cooperative and collaborative outcomes, then we would see, I hope, less violence of the kind of domestic or civil violence, but also less recourse to the building of armies and wartime violence. But I think the scenario is not quite as dire as you painted it. One of the remarkable patterns in this field of sexual violence during war is the extent to which women organize and fight back and comfort their daughters and sisters and demand change at the international level, at the national level, and indeed in some settings even at the local level. So there is a kind of agency on the part of women, often supported by their menfolk, that is quite inspiring.
You've said a couple of times during our conversation that you are at least somewhat optimistic, and yet doing this research as your career, it must get you down.
Well, sure. You know, I would not want to be reading some of these reports from the field and not be extremely saddened and enraged by what I'm reading. But what keeps me going is a number of things. So one is this fact that I've been kind of insisting on in the literature and in various talks and policy venues, which is that not all armed groups engage in this. And that is a reason for hope. That should help us understand that this is not inevitable. The second is just meeting so many extraordinary men and women who work on this issue, whether they are prosecutors, either in the civilian justice system or the military justice system, or ordinary people working in their town to try to get teenage boys to understand that women have to be treated in a way. There's just activists and advocates on this issue across so many settings, so many national settings, that I just find very inspiring. So that helps me to continue to want to do my little bit. And the last is that even in the time that I've been working on this issue, I've seen a lot of change. So it's become a big item on the international policy agenda and some national policy agendas. I think we don't know yet enough about what kind of policies really are effective towards lessening the incidence of wartime rape. But just the fact that it is now an issue that is not neglected is very encouraging.
What are the big research questions that really still need to be answered in this field that you're working on or that your colleagues are working on?
Well, one is what I just mentioned, which is the evaluation of these new policies to lessen sexual violence, to understand which of them are effective and, more importantly, why. So if it's true that this new program for the U.S. Navy basic training is more effective, we need to document that, see if it's true, and then figure out why that particular effort, rather than some of the other efforts within the U.S. military, has been effective in lessening sexual assault against fellow service women and men. So that, I think, is the biggest need right now in this field. There is, though, an ongoing need for better data. We have some fairly refined data from a few conflicts. We have quite coarse data that's been gathered by my colleague Derek K. Cohen at Harvard, who I mentioned earlier, across all civil conflicts. And there are some very well done, ethically done household surveys that, within a whole series of questions about what kind of violence a family suffered during the war, there are inserted some questions about sexual violence. But the data remains very uneven, and we just need more data. But we need always to gather that data in ways that are very ethical. And in this field, that's not easy.
It's not easy because basically you're collecting data about things that are happening during wartime in war zones, which is not exactly where your political scientists with their clipboards are out there taking numbers.
Well, some of us are.
Really?
But yeah, but even afterwards, it can be very important to gather that data just to accumulate a sense of the needs of the population on the one hand, but also to understand really what happened and why in a given conflict. But it's difficult ethically for another reason, which is we need to gather this information in a way that does not bring further suffering to the victims. So, for example, if you have a way to do a survey that you go from tent to tent in a refugee camp and everybody knows you're there asking about wartime rape, and on many tents you just spend 30 seconds and then you spend 2 hours in one particular tent, everybody's going to know that something happened to that family. And so increasingly researchers, I'm happy to say, are taking that kind of concern more and more seriously, not to further stigmatize the victims.
How do you get around that?
Well, there are all sorts of ways. One is to embed the questions in surveys that have a bigger overarching purpose.
So each one takes a half an hour.
Each one takes a half an hour, exactly. Another turn in the research and something that I did was to decide that for my research, for academic reasons, though I hope it has policy implications, I would not work with victims at all. Instead, what I've been doing in my work is twofold. One is in conflicts around the world with a focus on particular ones. I talk to international and national agencies and non-governmental organizations to gather the best data I can about patterns of victimization. But my own primary research has been talking with members of armed groups to try to understand what happens in an armed group if somebody rapes. Are they punished? Is it just gossiped about? Is it tolerated by the chain of command? What are the dynamics leading to gang rape or gang torture in this armed group? So what I decided in front of these challenges was to work with the armed groups themselves. Now, it's true that some members of armed groups have also been victimized, but the kind of methodology I use is one of oral history. So I invite those I'm speaking with to tell me, how did they come to be involved in this war? And how did their family make a living? And how did the armed group arrive? And through a kind of oral history method, I turn control of the interview insofar as I can over to this former combatant to tell the story as they would like to tell it, as a way to understand life within an armed group and how it becomes possible to engage in this kind of violence.
Can you be sure always that they're telling you the truth?
No, of course not. Sometimes I know they're not telling me the truth, and we can then explore, perhaps in a very subtle way, what's going on as I continue to talk with them and interact with them. And I never presume that and know that it's just not possible for them to be in the course even of a very long interview to tell me the whole truth. But a lot of what I am gathering in these interviews is corroborated by other interviews, all sorts of different kinds of documentary sources. And also there is often a kind of consistency and internal coherence to the interview that leaves me with no doubt that a truth had been told, and often a very important one.
Do you have any way of knowing how it affects them to tell their stories to you?
I have taken care to learn how to engage with people about these topics that are often very difficult for the person I'm working with to recount. I always make sure through an initial conversation about the purpose of the study and about their right to decline without any consequence at all, that it is totally voluntary. I often stop the interview and make sure that the person does want to continue or maybe continue but on another subject. And so those are ways in which I try to leave a lot of the control of the interview, its content, whether it even continues in the hands of the person narrating it. That said, at the end of quite a number of these interviews, I've been told things like, I never told anybody the whole story before, or I never shared that even with my family. So there can be in these settings, as somebody coming from the outside, asking in an informed and empathetic way for the history of who they were in the war and who they are as the war left them, that can be very engaging for people as they recount their lives.
Elizabeth Wood is a professor of political science at Yale University. She's a member of the external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
It's really been a pleasure, Mary Charlotte.